Peter B. Collins News and Comment, Monday, June 11th, 2012. Our opening music today from Bob Welch, the Fleetwood Mac guitarist who passed away on Friday.
I've seen that girl in the corner. I'd like to take her out of her chains. Cause if I had my way with you, baby, I would be changing your life today.
Bob Welch played with Fleetwood Mac and went on to have a string of power pop hits in the 1970s.
Your eyes got me fine.
I got to meet him one time, a very nice man. To the news of the day, the U.S. Supreme Court has been our focus in our special coverage, and we'll get to the issues of Citizens United in just a moment. But the court declined to hear an appeal of important cases from Guantanamo Bay, announced on Monday. And this puts into an indefinite legal limbo over 60 men, and I'm just talking about the group from Yemen, 60-plus individuals who have been at Guantanamo for as long as 10 years already. They have been cleared for release because our government has determined they have no connection to terrorism. And yet, despite the hope of its Boumediene case a few years back, the U.S. Supreme Court turns a blind eye to the individuals who are not a risk to the United States and are not part of the ongoing global war on terror. They simply come from a nation that is a failed state, a proxy of the United States now, Yemen, and we believe it's too dangerous to send them home. It's a travesty. It is unconstitutional and deeply un-American. And in today's in-depth interview, we talk a little bit about the Supreme Court decision with Dr. Jeffrey Kay. He is a practicing psychologist who has also written powerful investigative pieces for truthout.org. And we get his reaction to the Supreme Court's refusal to hear these cases. And we go in-depth on his recent article, which talks about the application of a drug called mefloquine that has been given to virtually every prisoner held at Guantanamo. And it's nominally a drug to prevent malaria. But Dr. Kay makes a strong case that it's actually being used for its known side effects, which cause hallucinations, depression, suicidal tendencies, weird dreams, and it can last for quite a while. Stays in the system for about 5 months. I hope you'll listen to the interview. It's available to all, not just subscribers, because as we continue our special series about Citizens United, I want to make it available to all because, well, it's in our best interest to overturn this egregious case. And the New York Times gave it some coverage today without referring to the option offered by attorney Carl Mayer and the group from TEAM, the 11th Amendment Movement. But I give Adam Liptak some credit for at least bringing the case to a broader audience's attention. And he traces some of the history here that two members of the Montana State Supreme Court did not support the decision that is on appeal to the Supreme Court, not because they agreed with it, but because they felt that they were bound by the precedent that the federal Supreme Court set in the Citizens United decision. And even two of the Supreme Court justices who opposed the majority opinion in Citizens United criticized the Montana court and said we should reject their claim. Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote in February, "Lower courts are bound to follow this court's decisions until they are withdrawn or modified." And Justice Stephen Breyer, again, who opposed Citizens United, joined her in opposing those who oppose Citizens United. This is frickin' crazy. But they got to play by the rules, right? Well, will they play by the rules? Will they acknowledge that the 11th Amendment prevents them from considering this appeal from Montana? Well, Adam Liptak looks at the speculation of Supreme Court watchers and writes, the Supreme Court will almost certainly agree to review the Montana case. At the same time, there is little reason to think the five justices in the majority in Citizens United have changed their minds. The main question this Thursday, then, will be how the court will reverse the Montana decision. It could call for briefs, set the case for argument in the fall, and issue a decision well after that. Or it could use a favorite tool of the court led by Chief Justice Roberts, the summary reversal. 9 times so far this year, the court has issued an unsigned opinion, ruling on the merits of a dispute without full briefing or oral argument. These are dictates, not rulings or judgments. And in the Tulane Law Review, an article by Ira Robbins from American University is entitled Hiding Behind the Cloak of Invisibility. And it said that these opinions issued by the court without indication of authorship are, not appealing. In the first 6 years of Chief Justice Roberts' tenure, almost 9% of the court's opinions were done in this manner. So it's going to be an interesting week at the Supreme Court. And in today's in-depth interview regarding the challenge to the Montana ruling, we caught up with attorney Rob Hager. And Hager was the prevailing attorney in the Karen Silkwood case. He also has been a participant in cases related to Three Mile Island and Bhopal. And this is what he had to say about the 11th Amendment in this case that comes before the Supreme Court as soon as this week.
Now, on federalism, the 11th Amendment is the way that they articulated. Ultimately, they felt the structure of the Constitution would not allow the Supreme Court to tell states what to do in suits by private parties against states. But when the court immediately, in their first big case, immediately grabbed for power, there was this amazing response. There was a fear that, in fact, it would even break out into a civil war if there weren't a constitutional amendment to put the Supreme Court back in its place, and that's what the 11th Amendment was.
And I invite you to go to peterbcollins.com and listen to the full interview. In fact, listen to the whole podcast, because between Adam Fergetch and the attorney Rob Hager, there's some fascinating commentary, and also Dr. Jeff Kay's interview, I think, is well worth your time when you get around to it. There is other news from Washington today. The GOP-controlled House, and this is related to Citizens United, has blocked an effort to force the television stations to disclose who is buying political advertising on their stations. And this is something that is very easy for the TV owners to do. All the information about political advertising and all advertising is computerized. And it's very easy for them to put on a station's website, here is the status of current political advertising on this particular station. But the Republicans, at the behest of the TV business, have tried to maintain the secrecy of this information. And they basically have instructed the Federal Communications Commission to withdraw its order to television stations to reveal this information online in a timely manner. And they claim that this is proprietary information. Now, I do understand that because political advertising for candidates is offered at what's called the lowest unit rate, the TV stations feel that they don't want to disclose what those rates are because it can be bad for their business as they try to jack up rates for other advertisers. But that's tough. That's just tough, because this is a way of allowing politicians to buy advertising time, allowing super PACs to buy advertising time, and minimize the disclosure. Now, people who really want this information can go to each individual television station, and it's available in what's called the public file. But if it's really a public file, there should be no restriction on making it available via the internet. And this is just another clear sign that the Republican Party, at the behest of its corporate owners, is doing everything it can to shut down transparency and access to information. With that in mind, the predictions are growing more dire. about the prospect of Democrats regaining control of the House and maintaining the limited control they have of the U.S. Senate. Based on the outcome of California's primary last week, the opportunity for Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats to pick up 25 seats in the House is looking more and more difficult. There are two key races in California where well-positioned Democrats did not make it into the top two, so therefore will not be on the ballot in November. And there are other cases where Republicans are more competitive than they were in the past, and this does not bode well for Pelosi's prospects with the House. And on the Senate side, it's mostly due to Democratic retirements and the vulnerability of some of the placeholder senators who have been filling in for people who were recruited into the Obama administration. And so the prospects of regaining control of the Senate are dim. And this puts us back into a replay of 1996, when Bill Clinton won re-election, but did nothing and was unable to bring Democrats to the Hill. So he spent his last 4 years marginalized because he couldn't get any important legislation passed. And that's shaping up to be the best case here if Obama can hold on to the presidency. And, of course, as you've heard from my comments, I've got a lot of problems with the way he's been operating. Now to election issues. In the state of Michigan, the Democratic Party chair published an op-ed in today's Detroit News. And it's really fascinating because, as you know, Republicans across the country keep saying that we need voter ID laws, we need to scrub the registration rolls to prevent voter fraud. And there ain't no voter fraud out there. What he writes is, Michigan voters aren't the ones who've been engaging in election fraud, it's been the Republicans. One of the favorite myths is about dead voters. So the new Republican Secretary of State, Ruth Johnson in Michigan, started a secret study. Tens of thousands of voters were studied, and they found no evidence of dead voters voting in Michigan. Then she went on, like Rick Scott in Florida, and we'll get to him in a minute, to try to prove that non-citizens were voting. Well, they did a deep study of their presidential primary this past February of 2012 and found that four voters, which is 0.0003 of all voters, may have been non-citizens, and it appears that they were all Republicans. And so this goes on and on. There's a guy named Thaddeus McCotter, who is a right-wing Republican who represents a Detroit suburb near Plymouth and Northville. And to get his name on the ballot, he submitted 2,000 petition signatures to be eligible for the August primary. But only 244 of those were valid. And as the Democrat here points out, that is election fraud. And that happened here in California as well, where they claim it was wayward petition gatherers who submitted thousands of fraudulent signatures. Now to Florida, where Rick Scott took to the Fox News Channel, that hostile environment, to announce that his state of Florida is going to sue the Department of Homeland Security to gain access to a database that he thinks will give them more accurate information on citizenship status of Florida voters. Once again, the Republicans trying to create the facade of running honest elections while they purge likely Democratic voters and prevent them from participating. Pretty good editorial, the lead in Sunday's New York Times, about Republican antics on Capitol Hill. Now, a lot of the bills they pass in the House go nowhere because they can't get out of the Senate. But it tells you a lot about Republicans, for example. In their efforts to cut the budget, they want to completely gut the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which is supposed to be monitoring derivatives and these real estate swaps and other very volatile investment properties. Well, the Republicans want to kill that. They also refuse to give money to the Securities and Exchange Commission to carry out the new requirements of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Bill. And they want to cripple the Internal Revenue Service, limiting its ability to detect tax avoidance, particularly by businesses and the wealthy. Once again, they deliver for their clients. We've talked here over the last week about the disclosures of President Obama's Kill or Kill program. And I know some people are very uncomfortable when I call it assassination, but that's what it is. But the debate that swirls in Washington about this is over the disclosure of the Kill or Capture program, not the program itself. Charlie Savage, one of the better corporate news reporters who writes for the New York Times, has an analysis piece that was published on Sunday. And he points out that these leak cases are hard to prosecute, and that Eric Holder, the attorney general, has just assigned two United States attorneys, no special counsel, no separate independent counsel, but just two people who are already in that job, and he's asking them to review this case. Well, I believe that the leaks came from the White House or people aligned with the White House, and I believe that this is an investigation. As a Republican operative said in 2007 and 2008, to gum it to death and run out the clock. In Afghanistan, we did it again. Night raids bombed a residence that killed women and children. And Hamid Karzai, our puppet leader there, who has no legitimacy in Afghanistan, is working to limit the U.S. in this manner. There are 18 civilians killed in one airstrike just last week. And on Saturday night, General John Allen, the American who commands the NATO forces in Afghanistan, made a deal with Karzai, saying that, and the language is a little bit wobbly here, but that they will be curtailing nighttime raids by special ops forces, particularly on residences. I think this is another empty promise. This occurs at the same time that it's been announced that we're going to ratchet up drone raids into Pakistan. And one more item today, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been dinged by the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia related to the storage of nuclear waste on site at nuclear power plants, including those that are decommissioned, no longer operating. And this is a rare decision to have a pro-corporate government agency like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reprimanded by the courts. But they said that the commission has relied on faulty information, that it would be safe to store these spent fuel rods at the plants, and that they failed to investigate the individual situations in four different states. In the 1980s, Congress developed the, directed the Department of Energy to prepare a plan for storage at Yucca Mountain here in the West in Nevada. That site has never been made operational, and so the commission just threw together a plan saying, well, keep this shit at the plants where it is generated, and we'll pretend that it's safe. And we've seen from the Fukushima disaster that spent fuel on site is actually a risk as great, if not greater, than the meltdown of the reactors themselves. And the new prime minister in Japan is trying to build support to restart nuclear plants in that country. I believe that all but one have been shut down over the past year. And that was a kind of moment of nuclear pause that probably will not last. Hey, thanks for joining me today for news and comment. Drop me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.